term Brahman is being used to describe both. The first, in verse 3, what is being called Brahman is Prakriti. But here in verse 26, what is being referred to is the Brahman effulgence of the Lord, or the that which is completely spiritual. It's not that if you engage in full devotional service, then you come to the level of Maya. No. You transcend Maya. You transcend the modes of the Prakriti, of the material nature, immediately, and come to the level of the spiritual Brahman. And then in verse 27, Krishna makes a very interesting statement, particularly in regard to people who are impersonalists and who think that Krishna has come from the impersonal Brahman. Krishna says that the impersonal Brahman has come from me. It's based on me, pratishtha aham. Pratishtha, in this context, means established, like a foundation. So the Brahman is established or founded on Krishna. And our acharyas make the point in regard to the statement, it's the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. They make an interesting point that when a person first engages in devotional service, very enthusiastically, something like what is described in verse 26, really getting into devotional service, then Krishna says that they come to the level of Brahman. So what do we notice when we first get into Krishna consciousness? We notice we become very happy. You don't actually realize Krishna, that there's Krishna standing in front of me, talking to me. You don't realize that. That may come in time. But initially you just feel blissful and your mind clears a bit like that. So, Jiva Goswami says that that the realization of the neophyte devotee of Krishna, that the devotee becomes happy and a little more clear-headed in the very early stages of Krishna consciousness, he says this is a type of Brahman realization. Because you're realizing Krishna, but you're not realizing Krishna in person completely and entering into your relationship with him. You know, as far as Krishna in person is concerned, it's rather vague. Just some happiness and, you know, like that. Any questions? Well, to become Krishna conscious, you have to transcend all the modes, including goodness. But having said that, considering that we are under the modes to a greater extent at this point, of the mode from which you can most easily enter into Krishna consciousness is the mode of goodness. If you try to enter into Krishna consciousness from the mode of ignorance or the mode of passion, it's a lot more difficult. But the mode of goodness, because there's knowledge, it's illuminating like that, there's clear-headedness and purity, then it's like a stepping stone into the transcendental realm. It can be. Of course, if you become attached to the mode of goodness, then you'll fall down, as we've described. But if from the mode of goodness you then make efforts to get into Krishna consciousness, then relatively easily you can get into Krishna consciousness, actually. But from the mode of ignorance, to get into Krishna consciousness, it's very hard. Or the mode of passion, always disturbed by so many desires and hankerings and feelings and emotions and, you know, it's like that. But it's not exactly that the mode of goodness and Krishna consciousness are synonymous. For when the mode of goodness becomes Krishnaized, then it's known as Shuddha-sattva, pure goodness. That doesn't mean it's just like a better version of the mode of goodness. It means it's something else. It's another state. It's another state, actually. But of all the material states, that which most resembles it is the mode of goodness, and that which is most closely related. Yes. Sorry, I missed the last part. Well, yes, but not exactly. See, there's more to that statement. More than meets the eye and more than has often met the eyes of most devotees. There are three types of pious activities. One is called Bhoganmukhi. Bhoganmukhi. This is from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Actually, Prabhupada, if you read the 22nd chapter of the Madhya Lila, where the process of devotional disservice is being described to Sanatana Goswami, Prabhupada quotes Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who gives these three types of pious activity. So first, or one at least, is Bhoganmukhi Sukriti. Sukriti means pious activity, basically. But it's Bhoganmukhi. The result of it is bhog. You know what bhog is? Sense gratification. So that means material pious activity. Helping the starving people, building hospitals, and all that. Simply on the material platform, but it's clearly in the mode of goodness. Then he says there's mokshanmukhi sukriti, pious activity, which is of the nature of liberation, and it produces a result, not actually of liberation, but it sort of helps you advance in the general direction of liberation. So mokshanmukhi sukriti means like detachment, tolerance, peacefulness. These are pious qualities. They're conducive for liberation. They're conducive for liberation. Then there is bhakti unmukhi sukriti. These are pious activities which are devotional by nature. And they produce as a result like an impetus towards Krishna consciousness. But they are devotional by nature. They're not material pious activities by nature. They're devotional by nature. So this means giving a donation to the devotees, helping devotees, taking prasad, sponsoring some Krishna conscious activity. It's pious, but it's actually of a devotional nature. Now you may not really know that, yes, here are the devotees, and if I give money to them, I'll advance towards devotional service. You may not know. You may not have any idea. But the fact is that the nature of the activity, it's related to Krishna. Your awareness of that fact is irrelevant. But the fact is that it is related to Krishna. So the result that is produced is a result which brings you closer to Krishna. So it's that type of pious activity which brings a person to devotional service. Whereas bhoganmukhi sukriti, just plain material pious activity, won't help. Like, you know, there's one verse in the Bhagavatam in which I think Sukadeva or someone is reflecting about the cowherd boys. That here they are, playing with Krishna. So they ask the question, or the Sanskrit is, Krita Punya Punja. What sort of pious activities did these boys perform in their previous lifetimes? So that does not mean that they gave a lot of charity to the hungry people and all that, and they just they helped the blind people and helped old ladies across the road. It doesn't mean that. It means they performed a lot of devotional or Krishna-related activity. They may not have known. Some they may have known, some they may not have known. Whether they knew or not doesn't really matter. But they performed that type of activity which is called pious. One last question, Dr. James.
Verse 17, what does real knowledge refer to?
Well, it would mean some real knowledge about the material world, basically. Because Prabhupada in the purport is tending to apply it in terms of the person who's in the mode of goodness, but also influenced by Krishna consciousness. For such a person, it would mean real Krishna conscious knowledge would come. But if a person is actually simply in the mode of goodness, then they'll get some understanding, like Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur was saying, that, oh, I'm above passion and ignorance. He'll see it. He'll understand what is passion and ignorance. And he'll realize, yes, I'm above it. And then he'll feel happy. Oh, good. And he may even feel proud. So that's what I think. So I think we should end there. For tomorrow, so bear in mind what I said I was going to ask you questions about for the test and work on it. For tomorrow, please read chapters 15 and 16. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. The Supreme Person. And it begins with a description of this material world, a metaphorical type of description, in terms of it being like a tree. Not actually a tree, but a reflection of a tree. A reflection of a banyan tree. So we've passed out these little notes, which they're analyzing all the different statements because they're through the first couple of verses and purports. It would take us a while to draw them out. So I just drew them out myself. If you don't have one of these, please come and get one. So, we've heard in the 13th chapter, there's a description of the material world, or not just the material world, but description of the situation here, material nature, the living being, the super soul. And in the 13th chapter, Krishna said that the soul is entangled in the material nature because of the three modes. But in the 13th chapter, there were no clear statements about the three modes, what they are, how they work. It was just stated that there are these three modes, and the living beings are caught up in them. So then, the 14th chapter, it was giving a fairly elaborate description of what these modes are. Krishna said at the beginning of the 14th chapter that it's very important to understand this knowledge. He said it's the very best knowledge. Because in order for us to become liberated or really come to the platform of pure devotional service, we have to learn how to disentangle ourselves from the material world, or in other words, from the three modes. Now in chapter 15, Krishna is giving a further elaboration about the material world and how we should relate to the material world. And he's describing it as a banyan tree, or not actually as a banyan tree, but as a reflection of a banyan tree. He says the root is up, the branches are down. Prabhupada asked
the question, what sort of tree have you ever seen with its roots going up and its branches going down? Well, there is no such tree. But you may see it as a reflection of a real tree. So that's what this material world is. It's a reflection of the reality. And the reality is the spiritual realm. So Krishna is saying in the first few verses that we should understand, it's helpful to understand the material world in terms of its being like a reflection or like a banyan tree. And he describes different parts of the material world as if they're parts of the tree. And that's what is on these little sheets of paper that we passed out. So let's have a look at these little pieces of paper. The subjects which are described on this little piece of paper, they're found in the first two verses. But to simplify things, we've presented it in this form. So let us begin. The ground, what is the ground of the material world, or like the base of the whole thing, the cause? Desire. Everything is grounded in our desire. Then there is the main root, the one which is going up. So where is that located? It's in Brahmaloka, which is the topmost planet of this material realm. Or alternatively, Prabhupada says, it's rooted into the total material substance. Then there are other roots which go down. The main root is going up into the top levels of this material realm. The other roots are going down, and they're going into the human planetary systems, like here, in the forms of fruitive activities, attachment, aversion, all sorts of efforts, material efforts, which particularly go on this level. In the higher levels, generally, people are not endeavoring so fruitively. They're enjoying the results of all their fruitive efforts. And in the lower planets, people are not really endeavoring fruitively. They're suffering the results of their fruitive activities on this level. But on this level, the middle planetary systems, this is where all the intense materialistic activity is going on. So these secondary roots, these other roots, they're rooted into the human planetary system in the forms of various attachments and aversions. And from them come different sufferings and enjoyments. The branches of the different planetary systems, upper and lower. The leaves of the Vedic hymns, the twigs of the sense objects. The tips of the branches of the senses. The fruits are the results of one's activities. The results of one's dharma, arata, karma, and moksha. And what nourishes it all? What is feeding it and sustaining it? The modes. Now, we want you to learn this because this is for one question in our test. You're going to have to be able to present what is on this piece of paper to understand the material world in terms of it being the banyan tree, or the reflection of the banyan tree. So we're all caught up here. And Krishna says in the third verse that you have to cut it down. How? Through detachment. As we've mentioned on so many occasions now, in yoga, the principal activity in yoga is detachment from this material world. That is a characteristic of all types of yoga, be they personal or impersonal or whatever they may be. Where there is detachment, then one can take it that this is a form of yoga. So you cut down your attachment to this material world with the weapon of detachment. Now Krishna makes an interesting point in that verse, 3 or 3 and 4, that you can't see the real form of this tree in this world because you're so caught up in it. there's a well-known saying in Western civilization that you can't see the forest for the trees. Some of you would have heard that. You're so deeply in the forest that you can't see the whole forest. You can't see the whole situation because you're caught up in the immediate situation in the middle of so many trees. So we are caught up in this material world. And we can't see the whole situation because we're so caught up and attached to and absorbed in the very immediate situation. Our particular position in the forest of existence or in the banyan tree. The banyan tree is given here not just any sort of tree. Because the banyan tree, sometimes banyan trees grow very big. And you can't really tell where does it begin, where does it end. One devotee told me about how there used to be a banyan tree, supposedly, which began halfway from here to Calcutta. It began. That's, I don't know, 60 or 70 kilometers away from here. And it began there, and then the same tree continued on till the boundary, the border of Calcutta. Delhi. Well, that makes it even more fantastic. Anyway, the idea is that a banyan tree can be very big, and it can be very hard to figure out what is really what, and how is it all working. So that's the idea here. But of course, we're being told about this tree in terms of it being a reflection. And wherever there's a reflection, it means that there must be a real tree. That's very important. In this way, Krishna is indicating the spiritual realm, that there is a spiritual realm. And that the spiritual realm looks very, very similar to this realm, almost exactly the same. But the spiritual realm is real, and this realm is just a reflection. The reflection, you know, if you have a tree, a reflection of a tree, and you see in the reflection, you see some nice fruit, and you think, oh, let me pick the fruit and eat it. So if you try and pick the fruit out of the reflection, you'll see there's nothing there. So it's like that. The material world looks very good. Looks very promising. We can have a great time. Looks like it's got so many facilities. But when you try and grab hold of it and get something out of it, you see there's nothing there. Why does it look so good? Because it's a reflection of the real tree. And the real tree is very nice. Very, very nice, actually. But the reflection, it's simply superficial. And there's no substance to it whatsoever. So unfortunately, that's the position in material life. People are trying to draw something, some pleasure, out of the reflection. But the reflection doesn't have the capacity to supply any pleasure or anything at all. There's nothing there, basically. So therefore we should turn to the real tree. And in verse 4, or the second half of the translation of verses 3 and 4, Krishna indicates the spiritual realm. And in verse 5 he does the same thing. He indicates the real thing. Verse 5, he points out that if you become purified, if you actually become detached and become free of all the inequities of material existence, then you can enter into the eternal kingdom. Particularly, if you know how to surrender. I thought it was rather nice yesterday, Hanumat Preshaka Swami was talking about how devotees come along and join ISKCON, and they say, like, here I am, I surrender. I'm surrendering to Krishna. when they join the temple. Like, you know, when you've joined, that means you've surrendered. You're now the same surrendered soul that Krishna's talking about in Bhagavad Gita. Fully surrendered. But I think, as we all know, it's not quite that easy to surrender. There's a lot more to it than just saying, oh, I surrender. Like that. There's a lot more to it. You have to know how to surrender. Prabhupada referred to the process of surrender. He called it an adventure in surrender. An adventure. Meaning it's a whole thing you go through. It's mainly your mind, I guess, really. Work your way out of your conditioning and work your way out of your attachments. And try to become more attached to Krishna bit by bit. So you have to know how to surrender. That's why Krishna is giving this extra jnana here. So that we know how, like, to detach ourselves. What is the material world? In order to really detach yourself from the material world, you have to know what it is. Otherwise you can maintain attachments to it, but you won't be aware that you're attached. Like so many people think that to develop love for Krishna is the same thing as developing love for a member of the opposite sex. They think it's the same thing in so many cases. But that love, we all know, within this material world, that love is not really love, it's more lust. That we are looking at, people are looking at each other, and within themselves they're thinking, what can I get from this person? So verse 62, Krishna says, you have to surrender to him, utterly, full surrender to the Super Soul. And by his grace, not by my grace, but by his grace, the Super Soul's grace, you can achieve the ultimate goal of life. And in verse 63, Krishna says that thus I have explained to you knowledge which is still more confidential. So this was more confidential. And the other section, what was it, 49 to 55, is the confidential knowledge. So the confidential knowledge was dealing with what? Brahman. Now the more confidential knowledge is dealing with Paramatma. So actually in the purport to verse 63, Prabhupada makes it quite clear. The Lord has already explained to Arjuna the knowledge of Brahma-bhuta, Brahman realization. One who is in the Brahma-bhuta condition is joyful. He never laments, nor does he desire anything. That is due to confidential knowledge. And now in this section here, Krishna also discloses knowledge of the Super Soul. This is also Brahman knowledge, knowledge of Brahman. But it's superior, so it's more confidential. According to Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Krishna now, having spoken verse 63, says to Arjuna, all right, that's all. Now I've finished Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is now finished, after verse 63. But then Arjuna asks, that, you know, do you think you could just make it clear to me what is the real essence of all these things? Because we've just sort of poured it all out on my head again, all at the same time. Could you just please make it clear what is really, like, you know, the essence, really the heart of the matter? So then Krishna says, all right, because you're my very dear friend, I'll now tell you the supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge, guhyatamam. Confidential is guhyam, more confidential is guhyataram, and most confidential is guhyatamam. Guhyam, guhyataram, and guhyatamam. These are the three Sanskrit terms.
So Krishna is now going to give Sarva Guyatama, the most confidential. So what is that? Manmana Bhavamad Bhakta Madhyaji Mam Namaskar Mame Vaishyasi Satyante Padijane Priyasine. Always think of me, not him, the super soul, but me, Krishna. Two-armed Krishna. Always think of me. Become my devotee. Worship me. Offer your homage to me. And thus, what will happen? Always think of me, not him, the super soul, but me, Krishna. Two-armed Krishna. Always think of me. Become my devotee. Worship me. Offer your homage to me. And thus, what will happen? You'll come to me without fail. I promise you this because you're my very dear friend. So Krishna, if you remember in chapter 9, verse 31, Krishna, he was actually about to make a promise that Name Bhakta Pranashyati, that my devotee never perishes. But then he thought, wait a minute. People may not believe me, but they'll believe you. So you declare it, Arjuna. Kanteya Pratijani. Na me bhakta pranashyati. But now Krishna is saying, Pratijani, I promise. This is my promise. So Krishna is making his own promise here. So Arjuna, remembering what happened back in chapter 9, verse 31, Arjuna says, wait a minute, you're promising me something, but you may break your promise, so I may not come to you. So what's going on? And then Arjuna says, you're from Mathura, and people from Mathura have a reputation. They tell lies. You may have noticed. The local people, they are sometimes prone to be someone less than what we might consider to be truly honest, at least in a way that we can relate to. So Arjuna, he brought up that doubt, that you're promising me, but you're from Mathura, and people from Mathura are famous for telling lies, cheating, and breaking their promises. So how can I believe you? So Krishna says, yes, you're right. Quite true. We do break our promises, and I do. I do, definitely. I break my promise. But one thing you should understand about us people from Mathura, we never break our promises, the promises that we make to people we love. And I love you. So I won't break my promise to you. And then Krishna speaks, verse 66. That you just abandon all your other dharmas, and you just surrender to me, and I'll deliver you from sinful reaction. Don't fear, don't worry, because I love you. You're very dear to me, so I'll definitely look after you. Now there are five in the purport here. We'll just go through the purport very quickly, because this is another extremely important verse in Bhagavad Gita. There are five very important points in this purport. Let us just go through them. In the first paragraph, Prabhupada says that, if you look on page 851, the third line down, he has described in so many ways different types of religion. Now, in summarizing Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that Arjuna should give up all the processes that have been explained to him. He should simply surrender to Krishna. So, in other words, not only should Arjuna give up, like nationalistic dharma, family dharma, cat and dog dharma, basically just being like a simple materialist, but he should give up Jnana Yoga, Sankhya Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga,
He should give up all these other things and simply surrender to Krishna. Only bhakti. That's all. Very important point that many people don't understand. That surrender will save him from all kinds of sinful reactions. For the Lord personally promises to protect him. So that's point one. Now, second point. The idea is there very often that in order to practice yoga properly, you have to become free from sinful reactions. And even in the 8th chapter, Prabhupada says, it was said that only one who's become free from all sinful reactions can take to the worship of Lord Krishna. Thus, one may think that unless he's free from all sinful reactions, he cannot take to the surrendering process. You can't begin to practice bhakti or begin to surrender. But no. To such doubts, it is here said that even if one is not free from all sinful reactions, simply by the process of surrendering to Krishna, he's automatically freed. There's no need of strenuous effort to free oneself from sinful reactions. One should simply unhesitatingly accept Krishna as the supreme savior of all living entities. With faith and love, one should surrender to him. And then there's this nice verse from Hari Bhakti Vilas, Anukulyasu Sankalpa, Pranikulyasu Marjana. These are the 6 principles of surrender. Accepting everything favorable, rejecting everything unfavorable, seeing Krishna as being your master, having no other shelter than Krishna, being very meek and humble. And what's the last one? Six principles of surrender. Now the third point is that one may perform one's occupational duties according to one's position in Varnashram. But if by doing that one doesn't become Krishna conscious, then you're wasting your time. That was basically explained in 17th chapter. If you're acting according to your position in the 3 modes, but you're not acting in relation to the Supreme Amitabha Sat, then it's useless. It's useless. Then the 4th point is, one should always think oneself helpless. This is the bottom of page 851. And you should consider Krishna the only basis for his progress in life. And the 5th point, page 852, the paragraph which begins there, a few lines down. One should be attracted by Krishna, not other forms. Not other forms. Above all, Prabhupada says, one who's attracted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Krishna himself is the most perfect transcendentalist. So we should particularly focus on Krishna. So now, one should be very humble, feel oneself helpless and having no shelter other than Krishna. I mean, there's so many points in here that those points struck me particularly. Next section, verse 67 to 71, it's very interesting actually. It's entitled, according to our overview, Preaching and Studying Bhagavad Gita. But actually, what it is, Krishna is recommending now what service he appreciates the most. If you really want to be dear to him, then you should explain this knowledge, he says. First of all, he says in verse 67, the types of people you shouldn't explain it to. Of course, by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, Lord Chaitanya is even more merciful than Krishna. By Lord Chaitanya's mercy, you may even approach these people who Krishna says not to approach, not to explain these things to. People who are not austere,
people who are not devoted, people who are not already engaged in bhakti. Krishna is saying, don't approach those people. But Lord Chaitanya, he said, do approach them. There's a well-known story you've probably heard, that when Lord Chaitanya and the Panchatantra first started distributing the contents of the warehouse of Love of God, it was like a dam broke, and there was this huge flood of water coming down, and everyone got drowned in this inundation of Love of God. At least all the pious people, those already devotees, or at least were pious and nice and not sinful, but those who were sinful, like the Mayavadis, the students, the very determined fruitive workers, those people who weren't really so pious, they weren't able to drown. So there was this huge flood. Most of the people had already gone down to the bottom and drowned underneath it, the flood of Love of God. But there are these other people who couldn't drown, and their heads were bobbing out of the water. So the Panchatattva, they would swim around and find a head sticking out of the water and then push him down and drown him. So that's this type of person. Krishna would say, don't bother with them. But Lord Chaitanya would drown them in the ocean of love of God. So then, Krishna in verses 68 and 69, he explains how preaching the message of Bhagavad Gita is the best service. Best means that it's the most dear to Krishna. It pleases Krishna the most. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed. And at the end he'll come back to me. There's no servant in this world more dear to me than he. Nor will there ever be one more dear. So Krishna's explained, having said that you should be a devotee and serve me in devotion and think of me like this and worship me. Now he's saying, what is the best devotional service? Very nice of you. 71 is like a benediction that if you listen to Bhagavad Gita nicely, you'll go back to Godhead. Then verses 72 to 73, Krishna asks Arjuna, are you satisfied now? Is it clear to you now? And Arjuna says, yes, definitely. Now I'm free from doubt. My illusion's gone. I'm ready to do what you want. And then from there onwards, Sanjaya is giving like his own feelings and realizations to Dhritarashtra. We can well imagine how Dhritarashtra is feeling by now. He was worried at the beginning, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, what's going to happen? But now Sanjaya is so fired up that his hair is standing on end. He's experiencing bhava. And he's saying in these verses, like verse 78, wherever there's Krishna, the master of all mystics, wherever there's Arjuna, the supreme archer, there'll also certainly be opulence, victory, extraordinary power and morality. That is my opinion. That's Sanjaya's opinion. And fortunately, it's the right opinion also. And that's the end of Bhagavad Gita. So, let's just read a little bit from the purport. I'll read the last paragraph. The living entity in his original position is pure spirit. He's just like an atomic particle of the Supreme Spirit. Thus, Lord Krishna may be compared to the sun, and the living entities to sunshine. Because the living entities are the marginal energy of Krishna, they have a tendency to be in contact either with the material energy or with the spiritual energy. In other words, the living entity is situated between the two energies of the Lord. And because he belongs to the superior energy of the Lord, he has a particle of independence. By proper use of that independence, he comes under the direct order of Krishna. Thus, he attains his normal condition in the pleasure-giving potency. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports to the 18th chapter of Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of its conclusion, the perfection of renunciation. Jana Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki. Any comments or questions? Sorry, it was a little rushed, but wasn't really much you could do about it. But it is. Okay. Well, I was trying to explain it as we went along.
Well, A, this is like the first part of Bhagavad Gita, establishing karma yoga as being essential for people who are embodied or still under the influence of the body. B is like the analysis of material nature. C is continuing that, stressing the three modes, quite a significant section. Then Nishkam Karma Yoga, that was, well, it's also related to the first chapters, like chapter 3, chapter 5. Well, in the 18th chapter,
yeah.
It's according to your study guide. If you just follow, yeah, there's D, you see, it's D. So it's as... Then E, this is more confidential, that a person who's been through Nishkam Karma Yoga can go on then through Jnana Yoga, particularly Jnana Yoga was discussed, Brahman realization. But mention was made of Dhyana Yoga, which is part of Ashtanga Yoga. So we understand that it can be taken to refer to any of those yoga processes which are not specifically focused on Krishna, for one thing. And secondly, they involve basically inactivity, like meditation or thinking philosophically, analyzing like that. And then... chapter 6, yeah, Dhyana Yoga. And then wherever there's mention made, like the 5th chapter, there's a discussion about Sankhya, that a person who's, you know, the idea of watering the root of the tree and looking for the root of the tree. And then with the possibility, as we indicated in our diagram of the yoga ladder, the possibility that one may take to bhakti yoga. And of course Krishna said in the last verse of this section that the only way to realize him is bhakti yoga. So that if they don't take to bhakti yoga, they won't realize him, but they'll end up realizing Brahman. Then F is talking about the Nishkam Karma Yoga people, who are very advanced. So they're actually performing Nishkam, it's like a mixture of Nishkam Karma Yoga and Bhakti Yoga. They're kind of overlapping. Working, but in devotion, absorbed in Krishna, under the shelter of Krishna. And now, the realization can come of Paramatma. Paramatma realization, which was more confidential. Krishna was saying, surrender to him utterly. Well, chapter 5 was talking about how Nishkam Karma Yoga can lead to Paramatma realization. And then chapter 6 also, there was mention of how Nishkam Karma Yoga can lead to Paramatma realization. Then Arjuna asks, Krishna, well then Krishna says that's the end at verse 63. Now we've come to the end. But then Arjuna asks that, you know, you've just given me so much information in your summary. So much information. Can you just extract the main point and make it clear to me what's the main point? And Krishna says, all right. So then he goes on to section H, which was 64 to 66. Most confidential knowledge about becoming a devotee of Krishna, Bhagavan. And then the next section is It's just like an epilogue. Where to go from there? What do you do once you've surrendered? You say, okay, I surrender to you, to Krishna. I'll serve you. But now what do I do? It's like the Christians say, you must accept Jesus. But when you've accepted him, what do? Do you just stand there and say, well, I accept? No. Once you've accepted, then you have to manifest it. So what does Krishna say? What does he recommend? Preach. And that now Arjuna becomes firmly fixed, and then the battle takes place. Interesting.
This chapter, 47 verse,
Krishna
says, when one performs duty as a Vipanashram, Krishna sings.
Right, yeah. That's already been described, yeah.
But my doubt is, like in some kind of story about Kripuringa, it seems that he performed his duty perfectly, but he was not free from...
Yeah. No, he was. But he performed his duty properly all the time, except one time. Except one time. Right? You know the story. So one time he didn't perform his duty properly, and he had to pay the price. So just see what the price was. But otherwise, see, when he went to Yamaraj, Yamaraj told him, you have performed your duty so perfectly, it's amazing. You're due to enjoy tremendous, you know, good karma, heavenly sense gratification or whatever. But you made one mistake. And there's some suffering you're going to have to undergo. So which would you like first? And Rig said, well, better get the bad out of the way. And then I can just enjoy without having to worry about getting the bad in the future. So he accepted the bad first. Yeah, so that's the idea. Of course, another point which isn't mentioned here very clearly. It's like, you know, when you start going beneath the surface. If you perform your varnashram duties very nicely, but there's no bhakti at all, then you won't become free from sinful reactions. That's described in Nectar of Devotion particularly, and Chaitanya Charitamrita also. There has to be a touch of bhakti in karma or jnana, in terms of like ritualistic fruitive activities or Brahman realization. If there's no bhakti, then the karmi, even if he does his duties perfectly, he'll end up going to hell. And the jnani, even if he's like a staunch impersonalist, he'll fall down. He won't achieve Brahman. So, that's getting into it more deeply. But the basic idea as far as Varnashram itself is concerned is that if you do your duty, you know, that duty which is really your duty, you can't concoct and say, well, I think I'll do this duty. But it has to be really your duty according to Varnashram. Then the basic idea is there's no sinful reaction. Yeah. Well, that Sankhya Yoga was a mistake. It's not Sankhya Yoga. It's not. It's discussing Ashtanga Yoga, particularly the dhyana stage. There are 8 stages, dhyana is one, and it's particularly focusing on that. But it's meditation, yeah, just before samadhi. But then it also discusses other features of Ashtanga Yoga, so it's definitely Ashtanga Yoga. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, it's called Dhyana Yoga because it's mainly focusing on Dhyana Yoga. Yeah, well, this is what we said, that the modes are very important. You know, if you want to understand your position in material existence, then understand it in terms of the modes. But other descriptions have been given, like the banyan tree, and
person and that, prakriti. But the main idea is the modes to understand material nature and how we're entangled in it. That's why it's getting stressed so much. So now, I hope you're clear on what we're going to ask you about tomorrow. Let us just run through it. We're going to ask you these questions about the modes, right? That we just mentioned today. We're going to ask you four verses. We're going to ask you for the, like the chapter 13, brief, very brief analysis. What are the six subjects discussed? And a couple, say, two of the characteristics, where the characteristics are stated. Sorry? The characteristics of each one of the six. Prakriti is material nature. But then what are the characteristics? It's all there on that sheet I gave you. It's beginningless. That was the first one. It's composed of three modes. And there were a number of others. Then from chapters 9 and 10, verses 22, from chapter 9, verse 22, 30 and 31, and then the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10. Just have the basic idea of how Krishna is dealing with his devotees. Chapter 22 explains how Krishna deals with his devotees by supplying them things or preserving what they have, even if it goes against their karma. 30 and 31 were about if a devotee happens to make a serious mistake or any mistake, even a serious mistake, as long as he or she remains engaged in devotional service, then they remain saintly and Krishna protects them. Then the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita was explaining about how Krishna reveals himself to his devotees and helps his devotees by giving them knowledge on all levels, even the neophyte level, right up to the topmost level. Then the banyan tree, we wanted you to describe about what I gave you on that sheet, the nine features or nine points to do with the banyan tree. Did I forget anything? I think that's all. One last question.
In chapter 18, verse 71. It seems like a place for Krishna there is talking about pure devotional service and what's the best in preaching and everything, and then he says, if they hear from me, then they'll attend the fire. It sounds like a place because up to now he's established that if we do all this, we'll attend the kingdom of God.
You see, yeah, this is a benediction. If you look in Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll see that at the end of certain chapters, benedictions are given, which talk about, you know, achieving heaven or this or that. So that is there. It's like a Vedic practice to give these benedictions. Now Krishna does say, Api Mukta Shubham Lokam. You will achieve the liberated planets, which would indicate the kingdom of God. This is more like a benediction. Sometimes people, devotees, because they see that these benedictions are also there in Srimad Bhagavatam, they think that there's an element of karma in Srimad Bhagavatam, but there isn't. But it is a fact that Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita are beneficial spiritually, and they're also beneficial materially. We're going to have to end here. So we'll see you tomorrow morning. You can come at 9. I'll be here at 9. You can start then. And all glories to Srila Prabhupada.